Hey, on this episode, we are talking about everybody's favorite 80s movie. Well, what should be everybody's favorite 80s movie? And that is Clue with Tim Curry and a whole cast of wonderful people. But we are your cast for the podcast here. Welcome to Movie Chatter. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Movie Chatter. I'm Eric. I'm here with Lou and Robin. Robin, how are you doing tonight?
I am clearly missing all the beats, but
that's okay.
Because I couldn't find the join button. There's some sort of join call button.
We'll get you some EDM music and kind of teach you about beats.
But speaking of beats, I have to tell you,
yes,
I am so excited. I have been like waiting to discuss this movie.
Yeah.
Even though I really have been waiting because I've been doing 4+2+1+1 all week.
Plus one.
But it's going to be fun.
Awesome. Lou, how are you doing?
I am doing great as well. I'm looking forward to this movie. I'd forgotten how much fun this movie was until I watched it.
This
again for this. Yeah.
Just, it's such a fun movie and it ages well. And
it's funny. Well, Robin and her husband, who is another co-host on the network.
Yeah, we're not going to mention Tim's name on the show because, privacy.
Don't mention Tim's name.
No. Don't give him a big head either. We're down visiting us over the weekend, last weekend. And we had watched this movie before for last week when we got, interrupted and couldn't do it. And then we found out Sharon had never seen it. So we're like, oh, well,
your wife.
Let's go back home and watch it. Yeah, my wife. Yes.
Never seen Clue.
There's a lot of things she's never seen.
Been out for 35 years now.
I know.
So they've been married for like 50. So
right. No, we haven't. No. So we went back and we watched it, the four of us. So it was great. Yeah. So I got to see it twice now in the last couple of weeks.
And so before we get into the discussion, what did Sharon think?
She enjoyed it.
Good.
Yeah. Goodness, that was good.
Okay. Now, before we talk Clue, something else happened since we recorded last, and we're going to have a brief discussion about it. And part of it is whether or not this would constitute a discussion on Movie Chatter. So Hamilton was released. We all know how I feel about musicals. Right?
Mm.
So
you love them. You secretly love them.
I love to trash them. I love the discussion content they provide. That is a type of love, right, Lou?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So, I saw Hamilton. Have you guys seen Hamilton? Either in person or on Disney Plus?
We have. Sharon and I started watching on Disney Plus. We got through to the first intermission and we got into it. We had to get something else to do, but we're going back to it. We enjoyed it. She likes musicals a lot more than I do, but I thought it was good and I'm watching it.
Okay. And Robin, you have not?
I have not yet.
Okay.
Waiting to.
I am about to start my third viewing.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Got the soundtrack. I'm very impressed. I'm typically impressed by Lin-Manuel Miranda. So I'm not all that surprised that I was impressed by this. I don't know whether it counts as a movie because it's a movie presentation. It was going to be a theatrical presentation of a stage show. So does that count for Movie Chatter? Does that, not for today's episode, but like, does that count? Do we have to do it as a Lin-Manuel Miranda episode where like we talk about actual movies and then cheat and sneak that in? Like, how do we do that? Do we want to do
that? You know what? We digressed once when we talked about a director.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about an actor before too, haven't we?
Yeah.
Robert Downey Jr.
So we can be musical centric for a moment, which would make me so very happy on the inside.
I may have to bring in a guest for it too.
Why?
Well, because I know someone who actually is much more familiar with music than I am when it comes to the actual craftsmanship of like writing or theatrical performances and such. I don't know. I'll see. You were about to say something, Lou?
I was going to say, I think the discussion is worthy because we can talk about, the reason this came out on movie and being pushed so far ahead of when it was supposed to be released. And just, in general, does this replace the performance, live performance? Is it, you know, how would you rather see this? Is it worth seeing it if you haven't seen the live performance? I mean, I think there's a lot of points we can talk about with this one.
Okay.
Right. I think so too.
Then
and actually every time I bring it up in like quote unquote hallway conversations or with people, everybody's got an opinion about this.
Mm-hmm. And there are many,
you know,
many opinions.
Well, I mean, not just like, you know, the sky is blue. Yep. 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 Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, you know, this was like a coup, or, you know, this was ridiculous, or like a really informed, like they saw it and they were just like, wow, this, a really informed opinion, not just like I read a headline.
Right. We'll talk about this when we actually cover the movie, but it's surprising how it opened your eyes to a lot of stuff that happened at that time that we never really paid attention. If it ever was covered in my history books in school, I'd never paid attention to it. Oh. And then 3 pages later, we moved on to other content. Like, it wasn't something that I ever really knew. But then on the flip side of it, it is also dramatized. It's not literally accurate. There's a lot of creative, creative licensing, like embellishments and stuff that are made as one expects and as they've admitted to.
Yeah. I mean, this is not where you should go to get your history.
No, I know.
Yeah.
But, so we'll include that. So in bringing this back full circle, back to your comment about missing some beats, I had mentioned to Tim that he needs to check out some of Miranda's freestyle work because he was, for a long time before he did In the Heights, before he did Hamilton, he was a member of an improv group called Freestyle Love Supreme, which is now back and touring again through, I guess, well, they're not at the moment because everything's shut down, but they had come back and they're going to be touring through Broadway and stuff like that. And it's him. It's the guy that played Washington in Hamilton and a few other people that kind of rotate in and out. A very famous beatboxer named Shockwave. And they take improv suggestions from the audience and then on the spot create raps and songs and stuff. And it is, of all of the things that Miranda has a talent for, I think that impresses me more than anything else I've seen him do, including Hamilton. He's just like one of the best at that. So, I got to throw this out too. I'm sorry. It's been so long since I've had human interaction with people and Lou. I meant to include you in that, Lou. I watched Snowpiercer, the movie.
You did watch the movie?
I did. Now, you are the one who has or has not seen the movie?
I have seen the movie.
You've seen the movie.
I've seen the movie.
Okay.
I've seen the movie.
That was such a piece of trash.
Apparently, we don't care whether I've seen the movie, Lou.
We had a conversation, and between Tim and Lou, I thought one had seen the movie and one hadn't. Maybe it was the TV series.
He doesn't care if I'm a human, so it's okay.
Well, along with Lou's mom, we're just getting Tim and Lou confused all over the place. So.
I know. The whole thing is just a mess.
Sharon and I actually don't have this problem. We don't get them confused. I don't know.
Go figure. They get themselves confused, though. That's the really sad part.
That was just me.
I don't remember being in this photo. Oh, wait, that's not me.
Taking that selfie. Oh, that's really? Not me.
My gosh. Anyway, Snowpiercer, for all of the raving I've been doing about the television series, the movie was atrocious. It was crap. Like, I expected it to be bad. I did not expect it to be that bad. Holy cow. No wonder that people need convincing in order to watch the
TV
series.
That's why I've been so reluctant to watch this TV
show. Oh my gosh, Lou, you understated how bad that movie was.
But I want to know how that got made into a series. Somebody had to
go. I don't know. Like, that's,
hey, remember the Snowpiercer thing we did? Let's make a series out of that.
Not only did it make a series, Lou, it went straight to series without a pilot, and they signed for 2 seasons at once. And after watching this movie, I'm like, that was a miracle that it even got made.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that movie was so bad. Anyway, you need to watch I promise you the TV series is better. And I bring that up because David Diggs is one of the main characters in Hamilton and he's also the lead on the show. So
okay.
Clue. So Clue came out in 1985, and this was, I think, the first attempt to make a board game into a movie.
Could have been, yeah.
Since then, we've had Battleship. Which enough people warned me off of that I haven't actually seen.
I've seen it.
Was it as bad as people say?
It's. Remember we just talked about Snowpiercer?
Yeah. Is it better than Snowpiercer at least? Wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Not adding that
one
to my list.
It's again one of those things where the concept is so stupid. It's like, come on, really?
Right. Oh my gosh. Okay. So Battleship, there apparently is a Monopoly movie that's in the works. There is a Candyland movie that's in the works. Somebody at one point said there was a Chutes and Ladders game that they were trying to script.
All right. Everybody just needs to stop it.
Right. Yeah. But Clue, perhaps the only one that actually would not have you roll your eyes at the idea of it being made into a movie. I mean, this works.
Right. Yeah. I'll give you that. Yeah.
Pretty well. So, where to start? I guess we start with the cast and the directors. Who was this directed by? John Landis was the writer. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Lynn was the director. Robin, what do you know about Jonathan Lynn?
Not a whole lot.
Okay. I don't feel as bad then.
Honestly. I don't.
Wow. I don't know that any. I didn't know that.
Well,
I didn't like
My Cousin Vinny. So,
I thought that. I thought it was okay.
It was all right for the time.
Yeah, I mean.
Nuns on the Run.
A guy who does Nuns on the Run? Yeah, let's watch that.
My gosh.
Honestly, my guess is, again, he's probably more well-known in the TV world.
Maybe. And he has more writer credits.
In this country. Yeah.
And actually more actor credits than he does director credits. So.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he?
Well,
so he stuck the landing on this, though.
Yes.
You got to admit.
And this was one of the first things he directed, too. I think it definitely went downhill from there.
But I think beyond the writing and directing, I think, and I don't want to jump right to the cast, but I think that is the thing that makes this movie this movie.
I think really it is a combination between the wit of the writing.
Yeah.
Combined with the delivery of that wit by the cast. You can't have that kind of writing and not have really skilled delivery.
Right.
And I mean, so
the writing was spectacular, but when it comes to the delivery area, I mean, one thing I can't stress enough in this movie is how conversational the comebacks were, how quick and how fluid and how, it made me smile every time. I was like, that's awesome. That is really awesome.
And there's always things that you pick up on a third or fourth or fifth viewing. There's little comments or one of the best things. And to this, I will credit the director as well as, again, the cast. Little looks in the background that they have or give one another, or just these little subtle body movements that if you've seen it before and you know who did or didn't do what, the way they react to certain moments in the room, it's almost these little micro expressions, but they were obviously intentional because they fit what that character does or doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's brilliant. But let's go over the cast. Robin, do you want to go over the list? Do you have it up in front of you or you want me to do it?
I do. Okay. I do. You know why? Because there are people in this cast who I would worship. First of all, Tim Curry plays Wadsworth, the butler. Madeline Kahn plays Mrs. White. Christopher Lloyd, I'm sure you all remember a couple movie he did.
Way back.
Professor Plum. Eileen Brennan plays Mrs. Peacock. Michael McKean plays Mr. Green. Martin Mull, Colonel Mustard, and Leslie Ann Warren, best dress ever, plays Miss Scarlet. And then Jane Weidlin. Yep.
Was she from the Go-Go's?
Yeah.
That's where I recognize her. And I didn't even listen to the Go-Go's. I just.
Yeah, well, she's amazing in her own right. Plays a minor
part.
She doesn't. But it is a memorable part. And it is.
You're singing
Telegram Bang.
Yeah. And it's like, even in beat with the music. That's
the great.
That's the great. But see, I think, and Eric is not going to like me very much for this. Uh-oh. I think that if you understand the cadence and timing of comedy and improv combined, you have a good musical. And I think that if you think about this movie in terms of musical terms, this is why you've got the flow of these very memorable moments. Because if we start to think about these memorable moments, they're not memorable unless you've got the cadence.
You know why that comment upsets me is because you assume I wouldn't get that. I totally get that.
You don't like musicals.
I don't like musicals because I find most musicals are just dorky and shallow and musical for the sake of being musical, as opposed to what you just described, which many are. And especially comedy. Again, there's a certain timing and a cadence and a rhythm. No, I don't disagree with that at all. You did mention, you failed to mention Lee Ving as Mr. Boddy and Colleen Camp.
True.
Who best known as, crap, now I'm not going to remember the character's name from Police Academy. The tall woman who was like this hardcore cop thing.
She doesn't have a very large filmography. So
no, she doesn't. But anyway, I remember her from that. That's the thing. In this movie, a lot of these actors and actresses, people now aren't going to remember. Like, our generation will, but the newer generation won't. Tim Curry has done so many things. Of these is probably the most widely memorable across multiple generations. But, I mean, Michael McKean, wasn't he in Laverne and Shirley?
Yes.
And he was in Spinal Tap. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff. He's done various different comedy things.
He's in Better Call Saul, most recently, probably.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yep. Martin Mull, who is, I discovered a year or two ago, is actually a painter as well. But he was a comedian through a lot of different 80s movies. Leslie Ann Warren didn't do quite as much. Madeline Kahn has done a lot of stuff. Eileen Brennan has done a lot of stuff. And of course, we all know, I guess arguably Christopher Lloyd's probably the most recognizable because of Back to the Future.
But don't forget, these guys have done a lot of stuff in a bunch of different genres.
True. Yeah.
Like, sorry, you know, you would know any Broadway goer would know Madeline Kahn, right?
Sure.
Like there are.
And Tim Curry's done a lot of stage as well.
Exactly. So I think what makes it work is we can find ourselves in them at any point in our artistic lives.
Yeah. I'm just saying like the current, like the Gen Z people who are coming up who.
Right. They're not as prevalent today. Right.
It's because of the age
difference.
Yeah.
Now, one thing about the casting, we were talking about this when we were deciding on watching a movie again for the second time last weekend. Some of the casting that didn't happen, Wikipedia was, I was surprised to read some of this stuff. Carrie Fisher was originally supposed to be Miss Scarlet.
Really?
And she had to enter drug and alcohol rehab at the time, so she wasn't in there. And Tim Curry was not the first choice for the butler.
Right.
Leonard Rosser was, and they also wanted Rowan Atkinson before Tim Curry, and finally settled on Tim Curry.
I could see Rowan Atkinson pulling it off.
I'm not a big fan, but yeah.
I see,
but I mean,
Rowan Atkinson is one of those actors who he has a shtick and he does that. And if you don't like that, you tend to not like Rowan Atkinson, but he's also done other things. He's done some drama. He's done some, or straight-laced comedy, where he's not always the goofy, slapsticky kind of guy. I believe he could have pulled that off, though I completely understand why people are rolling their eyes at that because of what he's been typecast as.
Yeah.
And that, so the Rowan Atkinson character that he does, no, that would not have worked. And I don't think Carrie Fisher would have worked either. I think Leslie Ann Warren, again, kind of a smaller filmography than some of the other people here.
But I would have liked to see, I mean, I think she could have done a good job with that. I would like to see in that.
But. I don't think she could have I feel like she
she's
comes
not
across
a comedian.
Either. So there's that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she would, she comes across either as too serious or too angry in a lot of the roles that I've seen her in. And there's something about Miss Scarlet that is kind of more the floozy and the, you know, the madam. And yeah. I don't see Carrie Fisher pulling it off as well as Leslie Ann Warren did.
Honestly,
Leslie Ann Warren did a great job. So yeah.
Honestly, the Miss Scarlet character is sort of to me like a Madonna character or a Taylor Swift character or a Christy Teigen character. These are very, very, very intelligent, enterprising businesswomen who carry a slightly different persona.
I agree with you there. Right,
into their acts.
But she, the character, I'm not talking about the actress. I'm talking about the character, though, presents herself as a kind of going into what men would expect from her. Even though she's a smart, intelligent businesswoman and she's able to do that on the side, she knows men expect a certain thing. So she plays into that
to get what she needs
and what she wants as a businesswoman. Yeah.
So
So that's an important distinction. And I think, again, that is the sort of thing that Leslie Ann Warren pulls off and communicates well. Yeah. And I don't know that Carrie Fisher would have gotten that same type of point across. I think she would have done the businesswoman side of things really well, but not done that other thing as well. Or if she did, it would have come across as too heavy-handed. I'll do love to Carrie Fisher. I mean, it's Carrie Fisher, but I don't know. I think that the casting for this was just top notch. I can't think of a single character I would probably have replaced. This is just a really, really well cast movie.
Right. And that's thing. So, you know, I mean, obviously Knives Out was supposed to be a little bit more akin to this than not. Yeah. Right. They also tried to stack that, with, actors who can play characters, because that's what they did here. I mean, all of these actors are really well-known characters in their own right. You know, you pull Tim Curry out of Rocky Horror Picture Show and you know what I mean? And you just get, you put him in there because he's recognizable and you want to see what's going to happen and how he's going to embody this. And so the idea is, you know, these seven guests, a butler and a maid, are all drawn to this mansion.
And the cook.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Oh, and the cook. Yes. Yes. That's right. My mash holdout there. With the idea of, solving, they're not drawn there to solve a murder, but they're all drawn there for a particular reason. And in the course of the movie, most or all of them commit a series of murders in order to hide or not.
By the way, we are going to spoil this movie. It's 35 years old.
Yeah,
so.
I'm really trying not to spoil this movie, but we're just going to go ahead and spoil it. And so the entanglements, the relationships, the interrelationships, they all make for this great fodder. And I've been doing a little bit of research and there's a little part of me that wants to say that parts of this were improv'd. But I can't substantiate that. It's just a gut feeling that I have.
I think that there are some scenes that are obviously not because of the tightness of the lines. There were several lines where you had to get, like you had to deliver exactly this, had to be responded with exactly that with the timing thing. But then I think there were probably some other things that were a little bit more improv. And I think especially the body language was improv in a lot of cases.
One thing was definitely improv. And they talked about here on Wikipedia was the flames speech that Mrs. White gave,
which felt so improv. And I love that. That's a memorable moment of the film for me.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm really glad they left that in because it kind of fell apart, but it was the falling apart of it that really demonstrated that her character had finally broken.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there were just there were so many good. So back to what you were saying about the improv and stuff. And one of the things I liked about some of the more nuanced things that the characters who weren't speaking were doing. There's one scene, and I wish I kept the website. I got to say that this is not entirely my observation. As we were preparing to do this movie for the show, I came across a blog that was talking about this, and they picked one scene. It was the matchstick scene where they're chopping up the matchsticks. And they were talking about how, being that this was more of a British style presentation and stuff, for Americanized audiences, it probably would have been filmed differently, but they left it in. They let it kind of drag on longer than American filmmakers would have. No background music. And they pointed out all of these different little things. Like they chop up the matchsticks and you get like Professor Plum going and matching his stick up. And
right.
Yvette and Mr. Green had already matched up their sticks and they're like really long, right? And Professor Plum has this little, and he sneaks up between them and tries to match his up with Yvette's anyway, because it
made me smile and laugh. So I'm like, that's awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not even close. Plus then there's kind of the symbolism of him holding up this little tiny.
Damn it. Right. Right.
Ladies, just let them talk. It's okay.
It was funny.
She did that.
All of the moments surrounding that scene, as I went back and rewatched it after reading that article, it made a lot more sense to that scene. And there were moments where that kind of changed things for some of the characters going forward too. But it's interesting because that was that one scene where you didn't need a lot of dialogue, you didn't need music, and yet that was where you're watching intently, because that's where you get to see who gets paired up with whom. You're trying to figure out who the killer is. It's got to be one of those people. And they're about to get paired up with potentially their next victim. And the next narrative act of the film is all about the matching up of two characters. So now you have one character playing off of one character instead of an entire ensemble. So that's a really interesting moment, even though there's no particular tension, nobody's in danger. There's nothing that's inherently going to happen in that scene. And yet that scene is actually a meaningful moment in the film. As lame as that scene should have been by all rights.
Well, and I will give a nod to the writer about this. It is a very intellectually written piece. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the inside jokes, the jokes that bring you into the movie, like referring to the United Nations World Health Organization as, you know who, right? They make this very obvious, right? And that brings the intellectual part of us into the movie. And do you see that smirk on Eric's face right now? Gives you that smirk throughout the movie. Like,
there were several other lines about,
I get it.
United Nations and
intelligence,
Edgar Hoover.
And so it's one of the, and you just have to appreciate that sort of highbrow amongst the lowbrow humor. Mm-hmm.
And there was definitely that lowbrow humor thrown in as well. If you can't get that highbrow stuff, there's definitely enough slapstick there that is done creatively to make it work.
We had a French maid.
It was done well, and it was done creatively to the point where it didn't bother me, because slapstick bothers me a lot, especially if it's out of context. But in this one, it fit perfectly with the movie.
Because slapstick is usually cheap.
Yep.
And slapstick is usually the lack of wit. And yet, slapstick can be done with wit. If you go back to, even as far back as Charlie Chaplin, you can do slapstick and it be witty. It's just typically not done. It's done as a cheap writing gag. And I think this movie, this is an example of, there were moments that were better than others, but there was a decent amount that was just, it was witty in the moment. And it was funny.
Well, in my all-time favorite moment in the movie, which you all experienced with me trying to get into this particular stream, this particular moment tonight, is very slapsticky. right? And but it's for all of you who are going to watch the movie, watch for this when you see it. It's the let us in, let us out moment of the film where people are literally pushing, shoving each other to get either in or out of a room, could have fallen flat on its face if it didn't have the timing, if it didn't have the tempo, and if it didn't have all of those slapsticky components inserted there.
About that scene, I have a confession to make.
Yeah.
What?
So we were in where I worked at the time, our building had an elevator, and a few people got stuck on the elevator and standing on the outside of the door, banging on it. Let us in, let us in. They didn't maybe find the humor in it. Same way a couple of us on the outside of the elevator did. Nor did they respond in turn with the let us out. I was very disappointed in them. And I know at least one of them inside was a movie fan. So like, come on. Stuck elevator. Perfect time to use that gag. And it flew right over their heads. I mean, what are they thinking?
I mean, Eve.
They're stuck in an elevator. There's nothing else for them to think about. Come on.
Even right. With you guys tonight, all I had to do was type, let me in, let me in.
And, the Skype call, and then I'm responding, let us out. Yeah. Yeah. There were so many good moments in that movie, though, with the flaming, the flaming conversation, and the 1 + 2 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 2 + 1.
Right.
Like, there are just so many quotable moments from this film. And again, that's a testament to both the writer for putting this stuff down on page in the first place and the fact that this is just a superb ensemble cast at delivering not just the lines, but the timing of all of it. And there's a certain level of physicality to this movie, too. Some of the kind of slapsticky things you have to pull off with Yvette and Mr. Green going up the stairs into the attic. And so he's homosexual and she's dressed in this French maid outfit that is just so over the
French maidy,
right.
Oozing with sexuality. And so they're like the two most incompatible characters. And so they're coming up the attic stairs toward the camera situated at the top of the attic stairs. And the hallway for the stairs narrows and they end up having to lean into each other. And it's like, okay, so that's funny because like he wants nothing to do with her. She won't get anywhere with him. And, you know, and then it keeps going. And then it gets to the point where they're almost like contorting and they're about to fall backwards down the stairs. It's silly to describe it now, but like, as you're watching it, the fact that they went just a little bit further with it worked and yet they didn't linger on it. They moved on pretty quickly from it. So it got just that little jabbing at the end and moved on. There were a lot of moments like that.
So we've talked about the writers, we've talked about the ensemble and their chemistry that we think we could see. Mm-hmm. I need to also give a nod here to the costume designer, to the props person, to the artistic director. This is a period piece that works. Mm-hmm. Really well. This is, I think, Lou, why at the beginning of this episode you said, or you or Eric or said something about this has stood the test of time.
Well. Yeah, I mentioned
it's aged well. Yeah,
it really has.
And I'm going to say it's because of the costuming. It's because of the attention to detail. Even though there are certainly continuity editing moments that are cringeworthy, but I think every attention to detail to the time and place and characterization. So when you talk about building a character, you're also building a character, right, from the inside out and the outside in. And certainly the clothes that a character wears helps us understand who they are and what they are there to represent. And I do think that that was pulled off very well in this film. Mm-hmm.
And I think that I also think that the way the film was filmed, an elegant way of putting that, but I think that the way the movie was filmed also helps with that a little bit. You don't have an overabundance of a soundtrack. When you do, it's either classic songs from long ago, like, you know, Shake, Rattle and Roll, or it's when you have more of a score, like at the end where they're doing the, or maybe it was this that happened transitions with the title cards. It's this much older style music that fits that era. So you don't get lost in, there's nothing about this movie that really screams 80s other than perhaps just the cast selection itself, all being memorable people from that time period. You don't get any 80s-ish out of this. And even the manner of storytelling from the 80s, we look at things like pacing and that sort of thing. You got good shots. You didn't keep cutting away every 10 seconds, and yet you did cut enough to give you some visual interest in what's going on. I think the way the movie was filmed and edited, well, maybe not a primary factor in making it timeless, like what you were just describing with the set piece. I mean, just the mansion itself, the costumes, the props, et cetera. I think there's also something about just the presentation of the film that keeps it relevant today. And the writing is still funny. Watching it is still good. The pacing doesn't really drop below a threshold that we would find acceptable as audience members today. Just it continues to stick.
Lou, you were going to say something.
No, I lost track of what I was going to say, but
I rambled too long.
No, it's okay.
But I want to, add to that because the movie, so in film studies, we really look at diegetic and non-diegetic types of sounds, scores.
No. Just see, when you throw out big words like that, you have to explain to our audience what those mean.
All right. So when you were talking about Shake, Rattle and Roll, for example, you know, it was in a scene when they had turned on the radio in order to mask or help mask to law enforcement or whomever was trying to figure out what was going on, what was actually going on. And so they used diegetic sound that, which is things that you would naturally find in the movie. And they used it really well. And so even in the silences, when there was no sound emanating from inside the film or a soundtrack overlaying what was going on in the film, the silences are also a part of that. So when there is no music, that is still relevant to moving the story from one piece of the story to another.
Right.
And so that is important. And that is sometimes, you know, if you think about Star Wars, right? And I know we never, ever think about Star Wars on this particular network, but, you know, George Lucas laid a foundation for an entire series of movies by using John Williams to score characters, right? But this is sort of the opposite of that. Right. They allowed the time to score the movie.
Right.
And it was really, it's really brilliant. And that is such a delicate balance. You know, John Williams is fantastic at what he does, but it really does take a different kind of talent to know when to move music in or take music or sound out.
That's really wonderful. Does. There's a use of, I guess musical white space is effectively what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about white space in the context of graphic design, something Apple is really known for, and it draws your focus, right? When you've got a blank sheet and you just got a single word in the middle of it and maybe a logo, your focus goes straight to that. If it's too busy and in too many different directions, you get distracted from what the point of that print ad is. And with movies, it's kind of a similar sort of thing. You can either have something like you said with Star Wars, where it's the sweeping nonstop score, but it almost becomes a character in and of itself, or it represents individual characters throughout. Or the white space by having that absence gets you to focus more cleanly on what's there in the moment. And really, like, I don't know about you guys, I don't have music playing around me here right now as we're doing this recording. In our normal day-to-day lives, sometimes there might be music playing in the background, but you have a lot of moments where it's silent other than a dog barking outside and somebody mowing their lawn or the cat knocking something off the kitchen counter, whatever it is. So it's a little easier to relate and to get wrapped up in the moment and focus.
Yep.
So music can add things both by being present and it can add things by being absent. And that's something that doesn't get talked about a lot in film. Or at least not enough.
Oh, it gets talked about a lot.
Not in the circles I run in. Which is like the lack of, you have the existence of film studies classes and then you have the absence of them. And I am very much in that lacking latter group.
Mm-hmm. With this particular film, so much so that I was surprised that you remembered Shake, Rattle and Roll was on the radio in a particular scene. That's how seamless mm-hmm. diegetic and non-diegetic sound was used in this film. You know, the dogs, I think they were Dobermans, barking, the chains rattling.
German Shepherds at the beginning and Dobermans outside.
Outside, yes.
Where they're in the room with the big glass windows and stuff, which I never caught all this time until this last viewing. I'm like, wow, there are two different sets of dogs. Conservatory. Thank
you. Yeah. Two different sets of dogs. Yeah. The dogs guarding the conservatory, the dogs guarding the front door.
Right.
Right. And so, but all of it played in so well that to take the Dobermans out of the running into the conservatory, because obviously in the Borglum clue, right, the conservatory is actually a room where a murder could happen. And so they had to incorporate all those board game spaces mm-hmm. into the film in a way that worked. Right. And so right. they needed to make the conservatory menacing. So stick a Doberman outside to help prevent an escape.
And then you've got the secret passages that were in the board game as well.
Yeah.
I never got into the board game as a kid because it felt like it was too much rolling dice and moving around and not enough actually solving the murder mystery. So I always got bored with board game.
I loved the game as a kid. Loved it.
I think it might have been the people I was playing with too.
I was always Miss Scarlet, by the way.
Yeah.
You were, huh?
I don't know if you're surprised about this. Great dress.
There is an interesting theory I saw online that so the presentation is Mr. Body is the blackmailer, the guy that owns the mansion. And then it's revealed at the end of the three possible endings, the third one is considered the canonical one, that the butler mm-hmm. actually is Mr. Body. There is a theory mm-hmm. that it is at that matchstick breaking scene where Wadsworth, who is actually the butler, kind of starts to have a mental break and then assumes the identity of Mr. Body and was not really Mr. Body all along. He really was just the butler, but then kind of cracks and decides, hey, I'm going to be Mr. Body now. And I guess there's something about some subtle differences in Tim Curry's performance prior to that scene and after that scene that this person used to support that theory. But I don't know that I agree with it. I do appreciate the fact that it's another layer that you can go and peel back and watch this movie and try to figure out, is that possible? Is it not possible? Is this guy like off his rocker? Mm. But it's at least a valid opinion enough that then when you watch the movie again, you can get something else out of it. And again, it's another one of those movies where you get more on repeated viewings anyway.
So this is a movie with alternate endings, which was shot to have a different ending shown in a different theater, right?
Released in a theater. Yeah. It was not, we saw all three.
Right. Different theaters like were delivering different endings.
Right.
Right.
So do you guys have a favorite ending? I think I know Lou's.
I would have.
He said this line over and over and over again.
I heard there was a cut ending.
There was a fourth inning film that never got released.
Do you remember who it was? It's right on the tip of my tongue, but I don't remember.
I have to look back at the, where did I see it? Was it in?
I would have liked there to have been endings of each one of the different characters having done it.
That would have been cool. Yep.
No, honestly.
I prefer the real ending because it's...
You like rom-coms too. That's...
I don't typically like rom-coms. It's rare that I like rom-coms.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if they gave an ending for each one of the characters, that would be in character with the board game, right?
True.
Considerably, any one of them could have done it.
And then you can pick which one is your favorite.
The board game is random.
Because I don't think that the Miss Scarlet one was all that compelling. I do think it was better than the Miss Peacock one, which I thought was the worst. But honestly, it's the last ending that I find most interesting because it ties everything together in a way that, yes, it's complicated, but it fits absolutely perfectly. There's nothing really that falls apart in that. I mean, you could nitpick, but...
No, I agree.
It's more inclusive that way.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So the other two endings to me are frivolous.
Everybody has to have their own ending. You know, it's like saying ultimately the maid and Mr. Green have to fall in love.
Well, no.
It's like, no. They're not there to fall in love.
No, Mr. Green's married and he's going to home and sleep with his wife. So
now you know Lou's favorite ending.
Yes.
I win.
I'm going home and sleep with my wife. Yeah.
I just think that's it's such a good ending that the other endings exist only for the sake of presenting multiple endings. That's my argument. And if you're going to do that, then either write better endings than the two that we got or give us a larger quantity of them.
So a little piece of trivia that I don't know if you guys caught up with, but each character arrives in a car related to the color of their character.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's cool.
Well, just a little teeny piece of trivia.
So Miss Scarlet and Professor Plum arrived in the same car, right? Well, I guess hers broke down. So you're going with the one that she was in initially. Okay. That's fair.
It's per the playing piece in the game. So Colonel Mustard drives a yellow Cadillac. Mrs. White drives a black and white MG convertible. Peacock drives a blue Packard. Green drives a green Plymouth. Scarlet drives a red Lincoln. And Plum drives a purple Pontiac.
Interesting.
I like
there's a lot of little subtle things like that.
Yeah.
Throughout the movie. Who was it that killed the cook? Refresh my memory. Was it Mr. Body?
I don't know, but if you all are MASH aficionados watchers or lovers or devotees like I am, the cook was Nurse Kelly in MASH.
No,
got nothing.
But so that's another example of subtle things that you don't pick up on. Body falls onto the floor. The knife is in the back. People go to reach for it. Colonel Mustard says, don't touch that. That's evidence. As he grabs the knife.
Yep.
And puts his fingerprints on it. And then they all get up. Like, oh, I never caught that on the other 12 times I've seen this movie. There are so many little tiny subtle things like that. The car colors. Moments like that, it's just brilliant. And that's another one of those things I have to wonder, was that improv? Was it written that way? Was it the director? Like, I don't know. There is a remake coming.
No.
Yes, there is. Originally, you might feel a little bit better about this in a moment. Originally, it was going to be Jason Bateman.
Although I like him, but no.
I did see that. Yeah, I heard about
so
that.
He has since stepped out. The other person who is attached to it is and to also produce is now going to be the lead name on the project, and that would be Ryan Reynolds.
Interesting, although I don't see. This is kind of one of those things where I don't think it should be remade because it's going to be it's so hard to do what they did.
I agree.
Right?
And that's the problem. Like there's nothing really wrong with this movie. What are you going to improve on? And you don't need to modernize it because it is perfectly set the way it is now. There's no reason to modernize it.
But wait, gentlemen.
Yes.
Boomers. So remember, no, she's so not talking Jumanji. About us.
I'm too so young Jumanji. For that. You're too old for that. I don't know who she's.
I did not want to see the reboots of Jumanji because mm-hmm. I felt the same way. You cannot replace Robin Williams, blah, 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 blah. And then when I saw it, I went,
oh, not brilliant. Remake. Sequel.
A sequel and totally reimagined.
And that,
there was a reboot. Reimagining.
Okay.
It was a reboot. So if they reboot Clue.
That's another thing, too. There's remake, reimagining, reboot. And then unrelated sequel. So I consider something like Jumanji, where you're not continuing from that character, but the world has continued. I consider that to be an unrelated sequel or related sequel, but a non.
But it was a reboot. They moved from a board game mentality to a video.
But they also referenced
mentality.
The story elements from the first one and characters from the first one as if that still happened in this world. So this is a continuation of that world.
So yes, the game has changed. Do something similar. The game could change.
So go actually, back and revisit that same house as if it's like the descendants of the original or something.
No. Well, I have said to my children, we do family game night and it tends to be deck builder sort of current, right. Mm-hmm. Games. And I actually said to them this last time, I said, you know what, let's do an old-timey game night where we play Scrabble. I said, and I'll even serve old fashions and it, you know, it'll be like fun. And they were like, okay, boomer. And then, like, it was like, you know, okay.
Okay, but mom.
Like, oh, whatever.
I can't do Scrabble. Right?
But
my knowledge of the lexicon and vernacular sucks.
Roll your eyes at me until you bring me your firstborn child and I hop them up on, you know, chocolate and ice cream, send them home with you. It's grandma's so revenge. Evil. But it's like one of those moments where I think if they did it well, they could reboot it into virtual reality into an upload type of thing.
Here's who we've got on this. So James Bobbin is in talks to direct it. So Ryan Reynolds is, I think he's producer. Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, who wrote Deadpool, are amongst the writers. Jason Bateman, who had been on it, has since exited the project. I think he was going to have directed. So James Bobbin he's done comedy before. He's directed Sacha Baron Cohen. He's done Flight of the Conchords. He did The Muppets from 2011. I think he did the second one too, Muppets Most Wanted. The Dora the Explorer movie, which I haven't seen, but actually I've heard pretty decent things about.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have a cast yet. But I mean, so far, so good.
Yeah, but the other problem I have with this whole thing of a reboot or a remake or wherever you're going to call it, it's got to resonate with people going to the movies today. Who has played Clue in the last 15 years? How old is the board game sell now? There's no digital version of this. There's no updated version of this game.
I mean, the only way in which it works is that it's a murder mystery.
Right, but then why call it Clue?
Board games themselves have incorporated this concept. We've played Mansions of Madness. We've played Castles of King Ludwig. We just call it castles, right?
I see your point.
So Lou has a valid point, though. Like, why not name it after one of those that somebody might actually recognize? But the reality is the Clue board game logo and concept and stuff is familiar, even if people haven't played it. Like, my son knows what Monopoly is, and knew what Monopoly was even before he played some variations himself. He's like the Super Mario Kart version.
I think Monopoly is a little bit more well known than Clue is. I mean, you know, ask somebody in high school today if they know what Clue is.
They may never have played it.
I just don't know if you're going to get a response.
I mean, so if you don't do that and you want to do a murder mystery sort of thing, then you really don't have any other franchise that you can latch a name onto, number one. And number two, even though you don't get the kids in high school right now, and maybe not the college kids, you do get everybody older than that. You get you, you get me, you get Robin, and generations after ours. So you still have...
I'm not sure that's who they make a movie
75% of the demographic you're looking for understands the name, and for the 25% who don't, who arguably are the bigger spenders, money-wise... they know people who have, they will see the fact that there is an interest in seeing the movie, and that will at least get conversations going. So I agree with you that there's nothing inherent there. I think they're hoping that it's better than nothing and it will cause some piggyback to maybe get younger people into the theaters as well as all of us who would be going, unless it sucks.
Yeah, but if you just do a clever murder mystery, then you have Knives Out.
I was just going to say the same thing, Robin. Yeah.
Honestly, it's just like, you've got Jamie Lee Curtis. You've got fill in the blank. The guy.
Chris Evans.
Thank you.
Craig.
Snowpiercer. That was horrible. But honestly, I liked Clue better than Knives Out by like a lot.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah. So the idea is to capture that imagination and move it forward. Clearly Jumanji was not a board game before Jumanji, but it treaded on Jumanji's success and it brought it into the next century.
Right.
And that's what I appreciated about it. And then it stocked it with actors who could carry it. It known or unknown.
Right.
Even the blonde carried it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Bethany, I think her name was. I don't know what the actress's name was. But.
So I'm not necessarily in favor of a remake. I like Ryan Reynolds. I like the two writers. I like Jason Bateman, though he's no longer in it. But I just, to me, this movie, there's just nothing really to improve on, and it doesn't need a more modern take. So I don't know. Not on board.
See, I think Ryan Reynolds, even though I'm sure he's a very smart man, his aura would bring the lowbrow middle school boy comedy forefront, and that would turn me off.
He has done big time. Some things that were not comedy at all as well. There's a movie he did, I think it's called The Nines or something, really trippy movie. But was not at all a comedy by any stretch. He did, is it Buried? The one where he's a government contractor in Afghanistan or something like that. And he wakes up in a coffin that's buried and he's got a cell phone with like hardly any charge on it. And he's trying to, the entire movie is him in this coffin. Very much not a comedy. And if you're claustrophobic, it's traumatic watching it. In fact, he was talking about some of the traumatic experience of actually doing the filming. He apparently had like someone in an earwig, like an earpiece that in between takes, he was like, they're like kind of coaching him through, like trying to stay calm and not freak out and stuff like that, just from the claustrophobia of it. Anyway, really good movie. But I mean, he can pull off stuff like that. But then if you attach him to a comedy, you expect funny Deadpool. Ryan Reynolds. So yeah. I don't know. And again, comedy writers, you're bringing in comedy writers as well. Rhett Reese and who's the other one? I forget the name. Anyway, Paul Wernick. Good writers, good comedy writers, but Ryan Reynolds, I think, would be distracting. I think you need people like when this was filmed, Tim Curry was, I wouldn't say he was A-list, but like he was a veteran and he was well respected. He's not someone the paparazzi's following around Hollywood on a day-to-day basis, but you know, he's well respected. And all of these other people, Martin Mull, Madeline Kahn, et cetera, recognizable names, but you know, they're not, you know, the teens with their magazines. Parents ask your kids what or kids ask your parents, I guess, what those are. But like back in the day in the 80s, the quote, teeny boppers aren't concerned with Madeline Kahn and Christopher Lloyd and Leslie Ann Warren, but we recognize the names. It needs to be that here too. We can't have Sam Jackson and The Rock and Ryan Reynolds and, you know, whoever else
I
in
want
there.
Sam
Tom
Jackson
Hanks.
And The Rock.
You can't have right. that in Clue because then it,
right.
it's
you're not
going to
get a Meryl Streep. You're going right. to get, you know, yeah.
You need solid, recognizable B and C actors and actresses. You need to avoid A-list actors. Too distracting.
Got
to
bring in one or two.
I don't think so. If you bring in one, they distract from all the others. And right. you kind of assume, like, that's another thing with Knives Out. I kind of felt like, I don't want to spoil anything. There are too many times with TV shows. Here's a better example with TV shows. You're watching, I don't know, CSI Chicago or whatever the heck that franchise is now. And you get this this actor in the background and you're like, oh, yeah, that's Joe Pesci. Okay, well, he's a murderer. Why? Well, because you've got a bunch of people who are just in the background who aren't the main characters and they're all just spectators. And that one's Joe Pesci. You don't bring him in unless you need him for some sort of big, you know, yeah, I'm right, the murderer right. scene, right? So there are so many TV shows and sadly so many movies where when you bring in an A-list actor, unless they're the lead, in which case they're distracting from everything else, when they're not the lead, they're distracting in the sense that it's like, oh, well, obviously they did it. So you have to have a balanced cast all the way across. And again, Knives Out for me danced with that a little bit too much, and I figured out what was going on in part from casting as much as anything actually in the plot. There are certain patterns in Hollywood with things sometimes.
You know, maybe you're right, Eric. Maybe for me, the working here, if I take my personal history outside of the movie, mm-hmm. I think it worked because they were all on a level playing field.
Right.
There wasn't
they were peers.
The Sam Jackson
right.
With the, I don't know, C-list actor.
Right.
Right. There seemed to be this right peer. Yes, you're right. Peer mentality. Like, we ran into each other in improv school in Chicago, and then we ran into each other when we were in Hollywood, right? And so they sort of knew a little bit about each other, and they all sort of respected each other. And that's the vibe I got from this crew.
Yes.
I did not get a vibe of prima donnas. I didn't get a vibe of, ooh.
Yeah, no.
You know, Jim Curry, he was in Rocky Horror Picture Show. We have to worship him.
Right. Yeah, well, it was an ensemble cast. They all worked together to make this movie.
And I mean, everybody had scenes that they carried at some point.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right.
With the exception of probably the cook. Otherwise.
Well. Yeah,
everybody, the singing telegram, maybe not, but even in the police officer and the driver and stuff, there were scenes that really kind of focused on them. Mm-hmm. But as far as like the main characters, every single one of them had some sort of a story arc, even Yvette. And they got their moments.
And yeah,
I really think that, I mean, if you're going to bring in Ryan Reynolds to be in the cast, they all have to be A-list.
Yep.
You can't have an A-list and then a bunch of B-list. It's just too distracting.
It won't work.
You can't do it. They need to be peers.
And maybe that's what happened to Knives Out.
I really think it is. I liked the movie, but the parts of the movie I liked had less to do with the whodunit side of things and more about the how it was done and how is the one character going to get out of this. Everything else about the movie, I'm like, I don't even care about those scenes.
Yeah.
And it was in part because of that reason. I don't want to spoil Knives Out because I know a lot of people are still watching. I think it just hit Amazon Prime Video for free, I think.
Oh, okay, nice.
Just recently.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, so I don't want to spoil people, too much, but yeah.
People catch up.
People are trying. Anyway, I think that's going to do it for this episode. What are we going to cover next time around? We talked Hamilton a little bit. I think maybe we can do that soon, but you guys had an idea for next episode, right?
Well, we bantered about Old Guard.
Okay.
The Old Guard or Old Guard? The Old Guard.
I think it's the Old Guard. That's the new one on Netflix.
Yep.
Right?
Charlize Theron.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the two of you have seen it.
Yep. Well, Lou's almost.
I'm mostly through it. Yeah, I haven't finished it yet.
Okay.
How do you turn that off, Lou? All right.
I watch it a little bit at lunch here, a little bit at lunch there, you know.
You are a very disciplined man.
When you have, you know, breaks at work and that's the only time you have to watch things. I mean, I've done that.
It's not ideal, but it happens. And
it's a way to get through it. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, I walked into the living room. My husband said, "Hey, Charlize Theron." I went, "Sure, I'll watch it."
I don't know. I like her, but she's not like an automatic watch for me.
She was Atomic Blonde, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also didn't see that.
Oh, yeah. See, you have to see that. And then you'll just watch anything she's in.
Really? Okay. Remind me. I don't have my quote list in front of me, but remind me. I'll add that to my list.
What's the girl version of bromance?
BFF?
Is there a girl version of bromance?
Well, that's me and Charlize.
Okay.
Just saying.
I don't know. Girl crush?
Maybe girl crush. Sure. Like, okay. I just want to be her. Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of Movie Chatter. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening in on the podcast, if that's how you're getting this. Otherwise, maybe check this out on YouTube. Go to randomchatter.com/YouTube. And I know we've had a backlog of things to get posted. We are now finally, as of this week, catching up. That, by the way, is entirely my fault. I take full responsibility for that. But we've got a lot of good content on the YouTube channel. We would love it if you would subscribe and hit the like buttons there. And maybe after you're done watching an episode, stick around, start up another episode that apparently is a metric that YouTube likes and makes them happy. And so they like us better as a result. And so that's one way in which you can help support us. Another way is heading over to Patreon at randomchatter.com/Patreon. A lot of our donors to the network just donate $1 a month. That's it. And that really genuinely does help us keep the lights on. It defrays the operating costs. We are a nonprofit organization. We're not like pocketing that money and taking it home. It goes directly into the network. And if you do, even a dollar a month, our Discord server that opens up a whole bunch more channels beyond just the section that's available to everybody. And you can access that by going to randomchatter.com/Discord. And there is a Movie Chatter channel in that server. It's available to everybody. So hop in. Let us know what movies you would like to see us cover. Let us know what you thought about Clue. Are you looking forward to a remake, or do you think that's a bad idea? Let us know and give us suggestions for other movies to cover in the future. Lou and Robin, thank you for being here on the show today. Thanks to everybody in the chat room.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah,
I agree. I wish we need more movies like Clue. Dang it. Somebody better start working on that. Yeah. But in the meantime, check out our other episodes and we will see you again soon.